I know there are many sides to every story, and I mean no disrespect to the church or the government, but I think that these three girls, Masha, Katya, Nadia, yes? I think that they have done something courageous. I think they have paid the price for this act, and I pray for their freedom.
That, of course, was Madonna speaking in support of three jailed members of the feminist punk rock collective Pussy Riot during a concert in Moscow this Tuesday. A day later, on the final day of their trial, Maria Alohina, Yekaterina Samutsevich, and Nadezhda Tolokonikova were defiant in their closing statements.
You can only deprive me of what is only called freedom in Russia. It's the only kind of freedom that exists in Russia. But no one can take away my internal freedom. It lives on in my words, and it will live on thanks to the openness of the media, as thousands of people can read and hear this.
On the one hand, we are expecting a guilty verdict now. Next to the legal machine, we are nothing, so we have lost. On the other hand, we have won. The whole world sees that the criminal case against us has been fabricated. The system cannot hide the repressive nature of this trial. In the eyes of the international community, Russia once again looks very different from what Vladimir Putin is trying to present.
The truth is prevailing over lies, even though physically we're on trial. We are freer than those sitting on the side of the prosecution, because we can and do say what we want.
The court is scheduled to render its verdict in a week's time, on August 17th, with prosecutors seeking a 3-year prison sentence for the group's protest performance in Moscow's Christ the Savior Cathedral earlier this year. Kremlin watchers have interpreted the delay in issuing a verdict, which was expected this week, as an indication that the authorities have been caught off guard by the degree of sympathy and support the three have garnered, both inside Russia and abroad. The ruling elite and even President Vladimir Putin himself appear deeply divided over the case, which has turned into nothing short of a PR fiasco for the Kremlin. And then there are these three women themselves. Throughout the trial, they've been poised and articulate, keenly aware of the role they are playing in this little slice of Russian history. They've been contrite when appropriate, issuing a heartfelt apology for offending Orthodox Christians' religious sensibilities, but they've also been forceful in defending their actions and blistering in their critique of Putin's authoritarian rule and what they call his abuse of religion for political purposes. The trial, which was telecast live on the internet, has served to get their message out more effectively and to a wider audience than their controversial church performance ever did. And they have used this opportunity to the fullest. So regardless of what verdict comes down next week, has Pussy Riot already won? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
So, Kirill, let's get right to the heart of the matter today. Have these three women already won?
In what kind of battle?
Well, that's my question for you, yes. Since you're the one that likes to get philosophical.
So we don't know what the battle, the precise battle we are discussing just now. And that the answer depends on what was their initial intention.
Their initial intention, as far as I understand it, was to bring attention to the authoritarian nature of Putin's regime and to draw attention and to protest the close ties between the Kremlin and the Orthodox Church and what they considered Putin's inappropriate use of religion for political purposes. They seem to have gotten that message out to a pretty wide audience.
Sorry, whom we're speaking about? If we are speaking about a punk rock band, yes, it could be. It could be. But we are speaking about, the sort of contemporary artists. Never trust contemporary artists, because their initial intentions could be very different from what they're saying or speaking about and so on. This act in this Moscow Cathedral was a part of a very, very long history of so-called art actionism.
You mean going back to Grupo Vainar?
Yeah, not going back to French situationists.
Okay.
Yeah, and going back to Vienna actionists and a lot of various radical art groups in 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
They were carrying on that tradition, to be sure, but for purposes of today's Russia and what's going on in today's Russia, they seemed to me that they were trying to accomplish a very specific thing with this action, which happened in the context of a lot of actions that were carried out by Grupo Vainar before them and several actions that they themselves carried out before their controversial performance in Christ the Savior.
I think that their initial intention was more artistic than political. Mm-hmm. But then, day after day, week after week, during this process and so on, this trial and so on, process in Kafkian meaning of the word.
Mm-hmm.
So during all this time, this contemporary artistic issue or topic was becoming, and now it has became a political issue. And I think this is the very heart of the problem. Initially, it was part of their players, very interesting and very radical and very dangerous game, mm-hmm. which all this group of people, formerly Vainar art mm-hmm. group, and then divided into Vainar itself and Pussy Riot, because Nadia Talokonnikova previously was part of a group, Vainar art group, and so on. So they were playing a very interesting, very dangerous artistic game.
And I would remind you, this is not the very first provocative thing that the group of Vainar drew a enormous phallus on the drawbridge in St. Petersburg, yes. facing the FSB building.
Yes, that was a very, I think, significant artistic success.
Yes, it was, and nobody paid any price for that.
Yes, and they receive, by the way, they receive Kandinsky Prize.
Yes, they received the Kandinsky Prize. Pussy Riot themselves sang Putin Wet His Pants,
yes.
as we've noted
on
this podcast. On Red Square.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty provocative act. But when they took it to the Church of the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, I guess the authorities decided enough was enough. But in doing so, I mean, it's almost like they did hand a victory to them. This everybody would have forgotten about this little performance by now.
Yes, because it was, I think, that it was a grave political mistake by authorities and Russian Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the source of this mistake lies in the changed political context in Russia between the previous act of Pussy Riot in February.
Mm-hmm.
So this crucial change, dramatic change of the political context in Russia, that was the base of the changing of the authorities' reaction on this contemporary art gesture.
Mm-hmm.
Because when everything was not quiet, but almost quiet in Russia, so you can just overlook such things, and that is all. Some, 10,000 geeks will see this video clip on internet, and then they will forget about it next day, and that's all. But in the situation between the opposition rallies in December and in February, by the way, when I attended the February demonstration in Moscow, I saw Nadia Talokonnikova. She was part of LGBT column, and she was absolutely alone, not to join any ranks or with various feminist and so on groups, and so on. And that was after.
Mm-hmm. After the performance,
And for me, this is the symbol of the changing political context in Russia, which is the source of this stupid, absolutely stupid, and very erroneous prosecution of these girls by Russian authorities. That is my first answer.
Uh-huh.
My second answer in considering if this was a contemporary artist gesture or act or whatever, it failed. You're asking me,
As a contemporary. Why? Yes. Why so?
Because there were a lot of such things in New York and St. Patrick's Cathedral. It was the initial.
Well, that was a pure protest. If we're speaking about the ACT UP protest in December of 1989, was a pure protest aimed at a very specific policy of the Roman Catholic Church, its position on abortion, AIDS education, condoms, etc. That was aimed at that. It wasn't really performance art. It was a protest.
The initial similar act was in the beginning of 1950s, when members of it was not even the Situationist movement in Paris. It was a Lettrist, radical artist group. Some of their members, including Ivan Shiglov, he was a Russian emigre who lived in Paris and so on, they appeared in Notre Dame de Paris. And they had been arrested and prosecuted. And there were a lot of open letters written by French intellectuals, for sure, in support of them. And after, I don't remember exactly, but after two or three maybe a month, they just had been set free and freed, and that's all. And situation was over. So in the terms of contemporary art, it was a failure because it was kind of a repetition of of the things that everyone in this world knows very, very, very well. In political terms, they won.
I think you're right. I think that this has left the realm of art now and has become politics.
Yes.
It's not even really in our. And if you listen to the statements of these three women,
It's all about politics.
It's all about politics, and I'm gonna read some of them in detail as we continue the discussion. Have they done lasting damage to the regime? Because think about it this way: when this first happened, when this video first appeared on YouTube, there was a debate, there was a lot of people who would, don't exactly sympathize with the regime that thought that was inappropriate. They shouldn't have done that in a church. Now nobody's talking about that's not the frame of the debate anymore, because the authorities' response and decision to prosecute these women and the fact that they face potentially 7 years, potentially, according to the criminal code, with the prosecutors are asking for three. They're facing such a harsh sentence for such an act has changed the whole frame of the discussion from what they did back in February
to the authorities and to Russian Orthodox Church.
Into the Russian Orthodox Church. And in this sense, have they done some lasting damage to the regime right now?
Oh, we'll see soon in several upcoming forthcoming months. But I think the damage is very, very serious. And there are, two various damages to the reputation of Russian Orthodox Church and to the reputation of a Russian government. And it's very interesting that the very substance of this damage is different. Concerning Russian Orthodox Church, their attitude towards all this act was absolutely, absolutely stupid and counterproductive. Because in Christian terms, of course, that was a very serious, they broke canon law.
Right.
Yes, and objectively for the believers, they brought some damage to their thoughts and to their feelings towards the church. So we have to be, we must be objective in this sense.
And they've apologized for this.
Yes.
And they've apologized for this.
But we're now speaking not about the girls, we are speaking about the church.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of speaking in a very distanced, aristocratic tone about all these things, Orthodox Church, especially Patriarch and all those around him, including this priest, chaplain, and so on, they began to be involved in the discussion. It's not for the hierarchy of any Christian church to be involved in the discussion. Roman Pope is not a person who is discussing something with someone. He is just speaking about from his throne, from his place, speaking about what is the position of the church about this and this and this and this.
Well, the Pope does speak out on social issues.
On social issues, but not on church issues. Not about the canon or whatever, yeah? So he can speak about international politics. He can speak about, you know, social issues, about the poor people in Africa, whatever. But when such things happened in the church, inside the church, this is a very good reason to express an official and very balanced point of view of the whole institution. Church is a whole body, you know, and the opinion of this whole body is the opinion of the head of this whole body. In the case of Catholic Church, it's a Pope. In the case of Russian Orthodox Church, it's Patriarch. The way they were speaking about the issue was absolutely inappropriate, because they looked like and still look like you know, those Russian representatives of Russian intelligentsia who were involved in every discussion on the kitchen.
Right. So they got involved in the affairs of state.
Yes, yes. The very irritative tone. Such, you know, this lexics, including some words that are absolutely inappropriate for the clergy and so on. So that was the first mistake. The second mistake was that this attitude to this girl, that they had to be punished, but punished by state. So in this case, church just undermines the way or the mechanism of their, not cooperation, but their relationships with the state. Because state jurisdiction is justice is one thing, and church justice is another thing. State state, you know, courts and so on, they based on the state laws and the legislation which had been approved by parliament and whatever, whatever. And the church canon law or church law is based on absolutely various different principles.
And the church doesn't have the ability to imprison people anymore.
Yes, yes, yes. And they mixed.
Which was the point that these three young women were making when they staged their protests. They almost provoked the church and the state into proving their point.
Yes, and that is very different if you go back to the church. And that is very dangerous, not just to state. And this is very dangerous to the church. Because if church intervenes into their society, into their state legislation and so on, state, the authorities, they have absolutely their own right to intervene into the church field. You know?
Yeah.
So this border now is nearly destroyed. And that this thing is very, very, very dangerous, not just for Russian society and atheists, non-believers and whoever. And this is very dangerous for the church itself. And that is the second failure in this battle.
What about the how this regime is now, or how the authorities are viewed by the society? Because I don't know about you, but as I was watching these three women make their closing statements in their trial, it was amazing to me how poised they were. And I mean, they're all three of them are very educated, so I shouldn't say it was amazing how articulate they were, but how articulate they were under those very difficult circumstances with the whole world watching. I was a little bit impressed by, more than a little bit.
They became heroes.
They stole the trial, what they did. They turned the trial away from a trial on them and turned it into a trial of the authorities. They got applauded in the courtroom. the judge couldn't stop it. It was really something to watch. And they were very, very clear in articulating their case against the state, so to speak. Yeah. I believe it was Artyom Troitsky had a blog saying that the Pussy Riot has acquitted the state, vice versa.
It's exaggeration, but in some historical sense, they're similar to all these heroes of the end of second part of 19th century, Narodovoltsy and Narodniki. During all these trials against Vera Figner and all other revolutionaries who, by the way, who committed their real crimes. Mm-hmm. Against the bureaucracy, because some of them were terrorists and so on. And this is the third failure of the regime and the state. They grew up heroes, opposition heroes, from nothing.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say nothing, because these women are obviously very, very, very intelligent.
And not about the girls. I'm speaking about the incident. Yeah.
I mean, the parallel I would draw, and I have drawn in the blog and we've used here in the podcast, is the parallel with Joseph Brodsky, who was not a political figure at all and never tried to be or wanted to be. But by virtue of who he was, he ended up becoming one. And we all know the famous quote from Anna Akhmatova, what a great biography they're creating for our little redhead. And I can't say it enough times, the Kremlin has created just an amazing biography for these three women, regardless of whether they do any prison time.
So this ability to make enemies and heroes on the opposition side is a very interesting, you know, very interesting feature of Putin.3.
Yeah.
Yes, not .2, but I think now it's now Putin.3.
Do you interpret, before we move on to the next segment, I wanted to get a little bit of this into the discussion. Do you interpret the fact that the verdict was delayed? We were expecting a verdict this week. I was expecting a verdict this week, and I wasn't alone. We were all expecting verdicts this week. It's delayed for till next Friday, to the 17th of August. Does that suggest to you, because it certainly suggests to me, that they don't know what to do? Because we know this is Russian courts are not courts. They are not independent. This is a highly politicized case like this. They are clearly waiting for instructions from the Kremlin. And they're not getting instructions from the Kremlin right now. The instructions from the Kremlin appear to be a little bit muddled. Do you think that is indicative of the fact that the Kremlin just doesn't know what to do here?
I think there is one more important factor in this story.
Don't say the Olympics.
No, Madonna.
Madonna.
Madonna. They didn't want this verdict to coincide with the Madonna visit.
Do you think Madonna's visit was that
yes,
important?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Because if, you know, the verdict is, for instance, 2 years in prison or whatever, yeah? And the same day, Madonna's show in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, with all her words and so on, and she would be much more angry than now, mm-hmm. before the verdict. So Madonna she's a superstar. She's much more important for all the world than any Putin and Medvedev together. So that would be the ultimate PR disaster.
I hadn't thought of that aspect of it. I also wonder, though, do you think they're not sure what to do? Because imprisoning them would just drag this out. You know, they'd really create martyrs. But freeing them, they're going to lose some serious face.
They can free them because they spent, 8 months or
they can sentence them to 8 months and give them credit for time.
Yes,
that would still be a bit of a loss of face on this, since at first they were facing 7 years. Now the prosecutors asked for 3.
Yes, and the other side, they're asking for 2 years
suspended sentence. Do you think, this is the last question before we move on to the next topic, do you think the way the three women conducted themselves in court this week made it more likely or less likely that they're going to be acquitted? They were very defiant in their each one of them was extremely defiant in their closing statements. Mm-hmm. They made 3 very effective political speeches, which were blistering critiques of the regime, blistering critiques of the church. blistering critiques of how the regime has appropriated religion and distorted religion for its own purposes. While at the same time, they were very careful to apologize for offending anybody's religious sensibilities. Do you think they helped or hurt themselves from the point of view of getting a larger or no sentence at all in their actions in the trial?
The only thing I know absolutely that they will not be acquitted. I am very sorry,
really?
But this is so.
Why do you think that? Because I'm not sure right now.
I'm absolutely sure that if you are if it happened that you are inside all this, you know, justice, so-called justice machine in Russia, so you can't be freed from this without something, you know, damage to you.
Yeah? They've been in. Yeah. How many months is it now? It's
yes, but in the case if they would be acquitted, so the authorities they agree that they were wrong.
I see. So they have to find them guilty,
yes,
and sentence them to
keep
time served.
Them 7 months or okay. 6 months in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it would be the ultimate disaster for everything.
Right.
For everything.
So the face-saving out is sentencing, yes, them to time served.
I think so. 1 year suspended or one and a half. But I can be wrong. Everything is possible in the situation. And that is another very interesting subject we maybe discuss in next podcast or some of the next podcasts. So about the psychological climate, atmosphere now in political, spheres in Russia, because in some sense I feel this, that some gestures of the authorities and at the same time of the opposition are, you know, kind of hysterical,
mm-hmm.
And in this sense you can't predict anything.
Mm-hmm.
So anything could happen.
And we'll find out exactly 1 week from today.
Yeah.
In a few moments, we'll broaden this subject out a bit and ask the question, how successful have the Kremlin's opponents been in seizing control of Russia's political narrative? And how important is this for the country's future? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFURL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
In contrast to your other allegations, this particular story with Bastrykin looks quite insignificant. This is a 4-year-old story. Why did you bring this up now?
First of all, you should remember that there is a law on foreign agents that has come into force. We can't just mention a foreign agent and not note that he is a foreign agent. And since we have established that Bastrykin is a foreign agent, I would ask you to refer to him as foreign agent Bastrykin.
That drew a laugh from both Kirill and I.
One of the best jokes for the last 2 months in Russia.
That, of course, was anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny having a little fun during an interview on Doge TV this week. Navalny was playfully suggesting that since Russia has a law requiring NGOs receiving financing from abroad to register as foreign agents, and since Bastrykin himself owned a company in the Czech Republic, according to documents that Navalny himself dug up, then Bastrykin should himself be designated as a foreign agent. And Navalny will not say Bastrykin's name without calling him Foreign Agent Bastrykin. Navalny's linguistic jujitsu was also evident this week with the release of an easily downloadable computer application called a Truth Browser. This application, which is available on Google Chrome, translates Russian language web pages into Navalny speak. With a simple click of the mouse, Yedinaya Rossiya, or United Russia, magically changes, of course, into Partia Zhulikov Ivorov, or the Party of Swindlers and Thieves. And Navalny's nemesis, Investigative Committee Chief Alexander Bastrykin, That, of course, morphs into Inestrani Agent Bastrykin, or Foreign Agent Bastrykin. A childish prank? Perhaps, but one with deadly serious political undertones. Navalny's mischievous terminology has had a tendency to seep into Russia's political bloodstream and affect the larger zeitgeist and affect the larger conversation. This is, after all, the guy who originally came up with the phrase Partia Zhulikov Ivarov, the party of swindlers and thieves, and that has become part of Russia's political lexicon. And it's not just Navalny who's playing this game. As we discussed earlier, Pussy Riot very successfully managed to turn their own trial into a trial of the ruling elite, while Russia and the whole world watched. With the explosion of social media, the trend is only accelerating. The poet Adrian Rich once said that language is power. Language can be used as a means to change reality. Kirill, I know you love to get philosophical, and this is a big gift for you. Have Russia's rulers lost control of the narrative? And if so, what are the implications?
If this is a philosophy, this is a kind of analytical philosophy or language philosophy.
Yeah, it's linguistics, it's philosophy. The lines are blurred.
So let's speak in Wittgensteinian, you know.
I said get a little philosophical. Don't go
overboard. Sorry, it was just a joke. Another joke is that after this, you know, Pussy Riot song in the cathedral, Madonna... What, so, get away Putin? How it's in English?
Cast out Putin.
So my favorite phrase, I coined it to myself, is Madonna, increase my salary. So, speaking seriously, I'm not sure that post-Soviet rulers ever had any control of Russia's grand narrative or Russian, you know, mainstream discourse.
Not even Putin in his first
never,
two terms.
Never.
Even when Surkov was never, controlling never, the ideological sphere.
Never. They use and they used and they are trying to use it now, but they never had any control on of this. I can explain why. It's our favorite subject, the lack of absence of the ideology and so on. But if we are speaking about so-called grand narrative, it could be of two types. First of all, ideological, and second, religious.
Historical.
Historical, you can use historical narrative as ideological or religious. So if we try to analyze, you know, this public speech or grand narrative or, you know, grand discourse in post-Soviet Russia, you'll see that there is no any one grand narrative in the country or in the Russian society. There are several of them. The intelligentsia's narrative, kind of, you know, special speech. And we can divide this intelligentsia speech or the intelligentsia discourse into the Moscow and St. Petersburg and the provincial. They're different, absolutely different. And then we have a kind of a new language of creative class, which is absolutely different from intelligentsia way of discourse and speaking and so on. And then we have so-called just ordinary people speech, which is, you know, which you can find in Russian soap operas, TV soap operas, and so on. So there are a lot of them.
But if you rewind, say, 10 years, 7 years, 6 years, 5 years even, these narratives are all trying to catch the attention, if you will, of your average Russian, of not your intelligentsia or your creative class or your chinovniki, but of your average everyday middle Russia. I guess we talk about middle America. If you could talk about middle Russia, before the authorities had a distinct advantage in setting this grand narrative of what was going on. I thought Putin rather skillfully did it during his first two terms in the Kremlin. The narrative was that the 90s were a period of chaos. Russia was on its knees. Putin pulled Russia up from its knees. He took care of the oligarchs, and now we're a wealthy, powerful country again. That was the narrative in its crudest form. It worked. People believed it. People repeated it. But now People are calling United Russia the party of swindlers and thieves. People are referring to Bastrykin with a smile on their face. I'm talking about average people. This is branding. This is successful branding. This is and it's something Navalny has learned very well, the value of monotonous repetition of a phrase in order to get it to seep into the political bloodstream of the nation. This is something American political consultants teach their clients in every election cycle. And believe me, it's going on right now as America goes into another election cycle. And this is now able to be disseminated thanks to social networks. And this spread, if you go back 10 years and Navalny said Partia Zhulika Viverov, nobody would have heard it. Yeah, nobody would have heard it.
There was no such internet as it is.
And it's not even just it's where the internet's gone into this direction of social media and micro communities that are linked together.
I mean everything here. Yeah.
So there is something that's changed. I mean, in that before the Kremlin could set the narrative and put it on Channel One, and you could be pretty damn sure that your average Russian in the provinces was going to pick up this grand narrative and repeat it.
Anyway, I can't agree with you about that they had or was in charge of this grand narrative 7 or 8 years ago. They used it. They used some parts of various narratives or discourses in Russian society. And there were several very successful attempts. For instance, Zamochit v sortire.
Mm-hmm.
For instance,
wipe them out in the outhouses.
Yes, yes, it's about Chechen rebels. All this stuff about the knees and Russia.
Russia rising from the knees,
yes. Yeah. And some other things. But that was not just the one narrative. That was a mixture, kind of mixture of old Soviet narrative and kind of semi-criminal narrative and with the inclusion of some phrases or intonations of various Soviet movies.
Yes, but it all fit together into a larger meta-narrative of where Russia was and where it's going and who should get the credit for that.
Yes, yes, yes. If we want to define somehow all this mixture, it was a machist, powerful mixture of various elements, historically and aesthetically and so on. And they use it very, very, very well for several years during Surkov's, mm-hmm. when Surkov had been in charge of all this stuff. What do we see now? We don't see this kind of mixture even now on the first channel of federal TV
chaos.
And so on. Yes, it's absolute chaos. They're not just because they lost control of this grand narrative. There is no any one stream of this narrative, technically, technologically, in various aspects of this thing, because of internet, because of social networking, because of everything, and so
the rise of a confident middle class that can get its information independently.
Yes, but this is just the first point. The second point, maybe, and I am sure that you disagree with me.
Never be sure.
I'm sure.
Okay.
This powerful machist mixture of various discourses or narratives is still existing just now in Russia in opposition and at the same time on the other side.
I agree with that. I think you're right.
Let's return to Pussy Riot.
But it's not that they don't have a monopoly. This narrative is no longer a monopoly.
It's not a monopoly. It's a mainstream. If we will return to Pussy Riot case and all these discussions on social networks or various in Russian press and so on, in Russian media and so on, we'll see one interesting thing. I read a lot of texts about Pussy Riot case from the conservative side of this mm-hmm. discussion, from the opposition side. The most interesting thing about this that they use the same language, and that they use most of them, not all of them, but most of them, and they use the same metaphors for trying to describe the situation. For instance, I read a text by Alfred Koch.
Mm-hmm.
What did he write? Was writing about? These stupid girls, they did something, you know, as inappropriate. And but we have to be, you know, we have to forgive them, just to spank them and let them free.
Well, Nemtsov used that language as well.
So in this case, this is my very strong opinion. There is no any difference between Patriarch Kirill, Vladimir Putin, Boris Nemtsov, and Alfred Koch. It's a fake liberalism. It's a fake liberalism. Liberalism couldn't be based on the
spanking,
on the machist ideology, on all these things. And that is a very strong thing, and that's why I'm very, very disappointed with the Russian opposition, because that was a mainstream reaction for this case. Of course, there were some, you know, some reaction from the feminist groups, there were some reaction from some, you know, other authors and so on, but the mainstream was these three stupid girls, they did, you know...
And they're not they're not girls, they're women.
Yes.
They're all adults.
Yes, yes. But in Russian, devushka,
I know, I understand.
Different. But anyway, the tone, the content of this speech, which initially was to, you know, support them.
I know, yeah. No, I noticed that.
Yes, all this mainstream, really... was against them, not for them, because don't forget that Pussy Riot is a kind of feminist band.
Yes.
And no one, almost no one, just noticed that this is a feminist issue. And they asked not Christ. They asked a Virgin Mary.
Yes, the Virgin Mary. That's right. That's significant, actually.
Yes, this is very significant. And I think that this is a very serious point to think about Russian opposition and all these groups that supported the opposition movement. Because if Alfred Koch, he's not part of the opposition, but he's a prominent liberal, neoliberal, whatever. If Boris Nemtsov, if Sergei Parkhomenko, if some other people who were the organizers of all the opposition rallies and demonstrations in December, in February, in May, they could can speak in such a way. This is not a real opposition, and they don't want a real modernization of Russian life,
or at least that is not it's not seeping into their language.
To think about or to reflect about your wrong thinking is the first task of every politician.
Yes, I would agree with that.
It's not just for philosophers; it's for everyone of, but especially for politicians.
Going back to Navalny's antics, as we have time to get one more little bit of discussion in here. Going back to Navalny's antics, how effective do you think his branding of the United Russia as the party of swindlers and thieves, as Bastrykin, as foreign agent Bastrykin, his little web application, which is actually quite funny when you use it. How effective is this, do you think?
I think extremely effective. And I'm not a philosopher, and I'm not, you know, psychoanalytic and so on, but in some psychological terms, there are two ways of, you know, public discourse. One is paranoid, another one is schizophrenic. Paranoid is always is more effective than schizophrenic. All these efforts of Navalny, they're paranoid because he's focused on the one and only one thing. And the official language now, official propaganda or whatever, discourse, is schizophrenic, mm-hmm. because they're trying to be, first of all, inside the limits of law and democracy and all this stuff, and at the same time they're trying to use their old languages, old language from the criminal Soviet movies of mm-hmm. 1970s, 1980s. So this is absolutely schizophrenic way of speech, yeah? And Navalny here, in this sense, it's not, I'm not insulting someone, it's just academic discussion, yeah?
Well, the way an American political consultant would say is that Navalny is on message.
Yeah.
They would say he has message discipline.
Yeah.
And he has, if you watch his interviews, he has relentless message discipline. He doesn't say Yedinaya Rossiya. He says Partii Zhulika Viverov. He doesn't say Alexander Bastrykin. He says Inostrani Agent Bastrykin.
This is a paranoid, and absolutely.
And I'm sure he's going to add many, many, many new words to his dictionary,
yes.
as the months progress. And if these continue to get into the discourse, this is how much effect is this going to have?
This is very monotonous. This is very effective, like, you know, techno music.
Yeah.
So techno was very extremely popular in 1990s. Everyone was speaking about techno revolution in 1990s. Mm. So that was a great success. I think this is the same thing. And moreover, now it's time. It's very interesting. I hope we'll discuss it in some future podcasts and so on. It's about the context of a modern Russian culture. Modern Russian culture, especially modern Russian literature, is not about some sophisticated things.
Mm-hmm.
It's about very simple, direct,
mm-hmm.
monotonous,
mm-hmm.
and paranoid. And that is the reason of West popularity of such writers of like Zakhar Prilepin, Dmitry mm-hmm. Bykov, and so on. It's my humble opinion, they're very bad writers. They're very bad writers, extremely bad writers. But they're very popular because of this, you know, public interest to such things. Very simple, very straightforward. And very, in this psychological terms, paranoid.
Mm. Well, on that note, I guess we'll wrap up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for an interesting discussion, Kirill.
Thank you very much.
I'd also like to thank our producer, Pavel Balak, who is filling in for Tanya, who's taking a much-deserved vacation. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a brief hiatus next week, as both Kirill and I will be taking a short break. We'll be back on August 24th. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.